Welcome to Town Talk with Ted on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Over the next hour, you'll be introduced to business and local leaders who impact our community. Now, the recipient of three First Place Virginia Association of Broadcasters Awards and the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
Dr. Stephen Farnsworth from the University of Mary Washington here this morning. We are going to be talking about politics. Dr. Farnsworth, good to have you back this morning.
Always a pleasure, Ted.
This is always interesting. It's been too long since we've talked about all this stuff. I guess we'll start off with the presidential campaign. We're off and running. It's hard to believe that there are now 15 Republican candidates.
15 declared, and we may get 16 or 17 before the end of the month.
Yeah, because Kasich has said he is going to, and I don't remember in the past that many people out there are interested.
No, normally you do see a great deal of interest when a president is term limited because it's hard to beat an incumbent president. So when you are looking at an open seat election as this one is, that's going to bring out a lot of people. But even by the standards of a lot of people, this is still an awful lot of people. Last time there were about 10. 15 or more this time is really sort of so big that they're not even sure what to do with the debates, you know?
Yeah.
If you had 15, 17 people on a stage, you'd basically need stadium seating for the candidates. You'd need some sort of opportunity to sort of keep track of them, because if you say something and you wait for 15, 16 other people to talk, 45 minutes might have gone by before you get another word in. So they have a scenario. I want to talk about this debate system a little bit, if you don't mind, because I have strong feelings that Fox and CNN are making a major mistake in terms of this polling business. The idea that's being discussed right now is the top 10 get to be in the debate, and then they have like a children's table at Thanksgiving for the other candidates. The other 5 or 6 or 7 get to participate in some sort of forum in the community, sort of a consolation prize. Well, nobody in presidential politics wants to sit at the kids' table. I think a much better solution would be to just have a lottery. Say we're going to have 2 debate nights, and you get an A or a B ticket, and you go to the first night or the second night as you see fit. Because, I'm a pollster, and one of the things that I can tell you is that polls are not designed to make those very precise definitions between the 10th and the 11th candidate in the field. I mean, when you talk about survey research, it's an approximation. I mean, we know when somebody's at 50% and somebody else is at 49%, that's too close. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking about candidates who are at 2% or 2.3%, and that's the kind of distinction we'd be talking about between number 10 and number 11, or even smaller percentages than that, that's just not a good use of polling. It's really not fair to those candidates who are 11 and 12. If you look at this from the point of view of science, you have a very, very powerful claim, legally if not morally, for the candidates in 11 and 12 that they're indistinguishable from the candidates in 9 and 10.
Interesting. Has there been any move to consider that? Have you heard?
Raising it every chance I get in the media, but the situation right now is that they figure that this is the best solution. That they really are looking at a scenario where they think their ratings are better served by the top 10. But that's going to be tough, and it may create serious problems for the party in terms of who gets excluded. I wouldn't be surprised if Carly Fiorina, for example, the one woman who's running, won't make the top 10. Polls now show that she wouldn't. Bobby Jindal, an Asian American, a group that the Republicans need to do much better with. They lost Asian Americans 2-1 last time. Bobby Jindal also isn't right now in the top 10. Rick Santorum, who finished second last time in 2012 to Mitt Romney, who won Iowa, is also probably not in the top 10. And Kasich also shows up not in the top 10. So you're talking about 2 swing states, Pennsylvania and Ohio. Those are 2 guys who represent states that are prominent in the Big Ten, but they're not prominent in the Big Ten of presidential candidates. And so how many people do they want to piss off, these Republicans, when they think about trying to come up with a top 10 debate? It's a colossally bad idea to use polls as the mechanism for determining who gets in and who doesn't.
If I'm a candidate, if I'm one of these 15, 16, or 17, what do I need to be doing right now to try to distinguish myself with so many people out there?
Well, ultimately, and this is going to be a big problem for the Republicans, you have to be outrageous. you know, playing by the rules and coloring within the lines if you're 14 and 15 is not a smart strategy. We see with Donald Trump mm-hmm. that the best way to get media attention is to be outrageous. And so you're tempted, if you're a candidate sitting far back in the pack, worried about sitting at the children's table, you're going to have to think, I got to be crazy like Trump. And that's the only way you're going to get noticed. And so when the Republican Party in a general election has to worry about winning centrist voters, the last thing they need is more extreme views on immigration, more extreme views on a number of other issues that may do very well among the people who would participate in a Republican caucus or primary, but would be not helpful for the party in the general election when the votes that matter are really more in the center than they are in the primary system.
With so many people out there, and when we come back after our break, we'll get into some of the specific candidates. We could talk about Donald Trump for the whole show, but we'll get into some of the candidates. But how long do you think it will take to whittle this large number down to maybe 4 or 5?
Well, normally what happens is in these presidential cycles is that Iowa and New Hampshire, for no good reason other than they happen to be first, they don't represent America. I've always wondered why the other 48 states don't gang up on those two unrepresentative places and say you're done. But be that as it may, Iowa and New Hampshire call the shots. And normally they get the top two or three people in those races get to play in the games that follow. What's different about this year, and this is a sort of one of those be careful what you wish for situations, is the Citizens United decision has led to the creation of all these super PACs. And right now, about 80% of the money that's being donated for the Republican campaigns are not being donated directly to the candidates. That money's being donated to the super PACs backing the candidates. And because there aren't as many limits on how much you can give, you can basically give unlimited amounts of money to a super PAC. You've got a number of millionaires, billionaires, putting money into the race. That means that a candidate who doesn't get much support from voters doesn't need to worry about raising additional money. So you may end up with a situation where a lot of candidates are going to stay in the race, even if they don't do well in Iowa and New Hampshire. And you can understand why they would do that. If you look at this from the perspective of an individual candidate, you're as good as anybody else if you're looking at a field of 15. It's basically a jump ball. Everybody has their opportunities. And so a candidate who doesn't do well in Iowa and New Hampshire, let's say Bobby Jindal, he probably would do pretty well in South Carolina.
I was going to say, does he hang on to South Carolina?
In the old system, when he had to raise money in each iteration of this process, a candidate like a Bobby Jindal, who I wouldn't anticipate would do particularly well in the first two round of Iowa and New Hampshire, would have had to drop out. But now, if there's enough big money behind Bobby Jindal or Rick Santorum or any other candidate not in the top tier, they can stay. This could create a real problem for Republicans because the conversation is going to be very negative. With 15 people in the field, you try to distinguish yourself from the other Republicans, it's going to be very combative. The larger issue, and this gets back to the money, is it may also be very prolonged because everybody has enough money to keep playing, and because they figure their chances are about as good as everybody else in the field, there's no real incentive to stop. So if you like your politics, you may very well find this the election of a lifetime.
However, parties don't like prolonged. You want to at some point get your candidate as soon as you can, I think, and be able to start gathering behind that candidate.
Well, absolutely. When you think about all the money that's spent in primary campaigns, that's money that could be spent in a general election if the primary were settled more quickly. You know, if you think about the timing, too, you want to pivot to the center, the ideological middle, once you've gotten your nomination. And so the longer the process goes, the more things you're going to have to explain that you said that you wish you maybe hadn't said. And the longer it goes, the less money you're going to have and the less time. And that's, you know, a particular challenge for the Republicans in this cycle, because the Democrats do seem to have a pretty strong advantage for one candidate. And so as a result of that, you know, if the Democrats finish theirs early and the Republicans go long, that's going to be a problem. We see that. It's, you know, it's no more complicated necessarily than baseball playoffs or the Stanley Cup or something. Mm-hmm. If one team gets rid of their opponent in four games and the other one goes to seven, who's ready for the next round? You know, and that's the challenge I think that the Republicans are looking at in this cycle.
Dr. Stephen Farnsworth here, professor of political science and international affairs and the director of the Center for Leadership and Media Studies at the University of Mary Washington. We will all start talking about candidates. We'll talk about Donald Trump next on Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
Welcome back to Town Talk with Ted on News Talk 1230 WFVA. You can weigh in on today's Town Talk topic on Facebook. Just search News Talk 1230 WFVA. Now, your host, Ted Schubel.
Dr. Stephen Farnsworth from the University of Mary Washington here this morning. We are talking politics in the presidential race specifically this morning. What do you make of Donald Trump?
Well, Donald Trump, in another poll out last night, is ahead of the Republican field by a couple of points.
Yeah.
Now, again, we talked about margin of error a moment ago. Polls are approximation. But what's clear is that he's in the top round. He's clearly going to be at the adults' table in the debates. His support is comparable to that of Jeb Bush and Scott Walker. Okay, so we know that there are sort of three or four people who are doing pretty well so far.
Yeah.
But what really drives Trump's support, I think, is more about name recognition. Trump doesn't have a political background. He has a celebrity background. He's on TV. He's a TV star. And so I think a lot of the support that you get from Trump comes from one of two places. One is name recognition. And most people in America, other than, you know, maybe your audience and the two of us, are not going to really say, well, what's the difference between Santorum and Kasich? You know, that's not going to be a particular concern for most people at this stage. But but people say, oh, yeah, Trump. I know who Trump is. He's on TV. You know, you're fired.
Yep.
Well, you know, okay, well, that's fine. But then the second thing, Trump has been very good at the other issue we talked about a moment ago about being outrageous. I mean, how do you get noticed? By being outrageous. This is not helpful to the party, but it's very helpful to Donald Trump and his name recognition. And so he says things like, well, you know, I assume some Latinos are good people, but, you know, most of them, what did he say? That most of them were rapists and criminals of one sort or another, murderers. And so, well, with all that, you know, you say, okay, well, you know, that's going to get noticed. Reporters will love a good story, and Donald Trump is nothing but a good story. He's larger than life. He's like a cartoon character is the way I sort of think of him. I don't know that the Republicans will ever nominate a cartoon character, but certainly he will get a lot of media attention and do reasonably well in the polls. There's a lot of anger, I think, in this country over a lot of issues. And, you know, to take it in a more serious direction for a moment, you know, people are really sort of frustrated. The economy hasn't come back as fast as they thought. The good days that they remember from the past don't seem to be back. People are still struggling to pay their mortgages. They're worried about their retirements. There are a lot of issues of anger out there in this country. And I think one of the challenges that the candidates in both parties are going to face is how do they deal with that? It isn't just the Tea Party movement on the Republican side that we're talking about here. It's a lot of people who think that the world that their children inherit won't be as good as the world that they have right now or the world that their parents had 20 years ago. And that's going to be a significant challenge. And I think Trump so far has been better than some of the other Republicans at connecting with that anger or anxiety, if you prefer, about the future.
I saw an interview with him from his vineyard in Charlottesville the other day and actually sat and watched with knowing you were coming in and wanted to sit and watch it. And I watched the interview and he did touch on that. And that's what I was impressed with, that it was very straight talk about what this country needs. And as I watched it, I wondered how long can he stay relevant? You know, can he continue on in this?
Well, it's sort of hard to imagine that some sort of mogul can really channel effectively the anger of populism in this country. I mean, at a certain point, you know, it's a little tough to sell. Well, you know, and unlike almost every other politician in American history who tries to downplay how much money they have, Trump exaggerates
it.
You know, he says, I'm worth $10 billion, and he puts it in all caps in the news release so that the reporters don't miss it. And, you know, most people say, well, I'm a man of the people. You know, everybody was born in a log cabin in America when they run for politics. You know, they walked uphill to school both ways. They struggled on the family farm or in the family business or whatever it might be. And so they, you know, everybody comes up from poverty in American politics. Now, some people simply cannot claim that. Donald Trump is one of them. And he doesn't even try. And that's a challenge, I think, that he's going to have to face as we get further into this process. The lack of political experience will raise questions about what he could actually accomplish. So much of politics is about compromising and policy making, and not so much about rhetoric.
Mm-hmm.
How well he would do at coming up with a budget. This is an open question, and Trump will have to, you know, in the next stage of this campaign, deal with things a little more seriously than he has so far if he's going to be more than this season's Sarah Palin or Herman Cain.
And Herman Cain is who you hear that mentioned, that at this time 4 years ago, he was right up there, and he quickly left.
Yeah, the world of presidential politics is full of, like, presidents who never made it there. You know, we don't talk about a President Santorum or a President Dean, in part because this process tends to inflate candidates beyond their experience.
Yeah.
And then it tends to deflate them pretty rapidly. And so that may very well happen with Trump. Certainly there are a lot of Republicans looking at Trump and wondering what the party would do if he became the nominee.
Speaking of that, what would the Democrats do if Bernie Sanders was the nominee?
Well, when we turn to the Democrats, we're not looking at quite the free-for-all that you see on the Republican side. You know, there are basically a handful of candidates who are being discussed. Virginia has one possible candidate up in both of these races. You've got Jim Gilmore imagining himself as a front runner, but I tend to think it's kids' table for him on the Republican side. And then Jim Webb, who would be a very interesting candidate, a very thoughtful candidate. He may run for the Democratic nomination, but for the moment, the numbers really do look very good for Hillary Clinton. She has a viable rival in Bernie Sanders, but still pretty far ahead of him in the polls. And she has a huge money advantage and name recognition and so on. So I think for the Democrats, the challenge is going to be, you know, the question of Hillary Clinton. You know, I think that the challenge that Hillary Clinton has always faced throughout her career has been connecting with people. She is certainly not her husband when it comes time to work in crowds. And there's a certain tone deafness, mm-hmm. You know, and it's really astonishing to me looking at this. You know, most politicians, and Hillary Clinton among them, very smart, very hardworking. But she simply has not mastered this skill of connecting with people. And when she talks about things, she talks about them in a very defensive, bureaucratic way that really doesn't resonate with people. When she talks about leaving the White House dead broke, that's not how it works. You have a huge pension. She was elected to the Senate. The Senate pays over $150,000 a year. They have a house in Chappaqua. They have another house in Georgetown. This is not how Americans would describe dead broke. You know, sure, there were some legal bills to pay. Bill Clinton got into some legal trouble, as we all know so well. But the truth is that, you know, when you talk about that kind of thing, you really don't connect with ordinary Americans. You see with the Clinton campaign a kind of tone deafness.
Yeah.
The idea of corralling reporters at a campaign rally.
That was very odd.
It was, the pictures speak for themselves. You know, this is not a smart way to run a campaign. I think the Clinton campaign is wise to be defensive. I mean, for 20 years, the Clintons have had to play defense, and they're pretty good at it. But Hillary Clinton really needs to really, if she's going to be the nominee, get somewhere along the way an ability to speak more genuinely to people. There's, you know, when she does it, it can work very well. You know, when she talked about how emotionally she talked about how hard it was for her to be disliked in the 2008 campaign, that moment really crystallized her humanness, and that really helped her win New Hampshire. So I think that can work for her, but we're not seeing nearly enough of it. In terms of Bernie Sanders, I tend to think that the Democratic Party will not nominate Bernie Sanders. I think that he will do pretty – he has the potential, if current numbers are consistent with where we are at the end of the year, he could do pretty well in maybe Iowa and New Hampshire. But beyond that, I don't know that he has a significant national following with these larger states, and where money is going to be even more influential. And the truth of the matter is that if Hillary Clinton stumbles in a really big way, if Bernie Sanders comes out ahead in national polls or something, well, then all of a sudden we might be talking about a very different field. Then you might see Elizabeth Warren in the race. You might see Joe Biden in the race. I don't think either of them will get in the race as it stands right now with Hillary comfortably ahead. But if it looks like Hillary's not going to be the nominee, then it's a free-for-all. And that that creates a very different environment for Bernie Sanders than the one he's looking at right now. But so far, no doubt about it, Bernie Sanders has done pretty well. He's going up in the polls. He, not Martin O'Malley, the former governor of Maryland, is seen as the largest, most significant rival to Hillary Clinton. His issues are being talked about. He's on talk shows. And so from the point of view of Bernie Sanders, you know, his part of the conversation is going pretty well.
Martin O'Malley is an interesting study because when he first got into this, everyone said, you know, he could be the dark horse, and he just hasn't raised the money, and it just hasn't been there for him so far.
Well, and you know, the thing is that part of the problem is the inevitability that so many Democrats see with respect to Hillary Clinton. You know, one of the things you don't want to do is cross the Clintons. In politics. When Bill Clinton was first president, there was a conversation about NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. And a lot of environmental groups and union groups didn't like the North American Free Trade Agreement. They were concerned that, you know, it would lower environmental standards in the United States and lower labor standards in the United States. And no doubt about it, for the last 20 years, manufacturing has been on a steady exodus. Those manufacturing jobs have gone to cheaper wage countries because of globalization. And so, you know, and so the Clintons were very clear about this. If you, I know, you know, they talked to environmental groups and union groups, and people have been, you know, for 20 years have been smarting over the fact that they had to play ball. They, you know, had to curb their enthusiasm for fighting against NAFTA because they won't, otherwise they would never ever get anything from the Clintons again. In many ways, it's like a mafia. You know, if you don't keep your mouth shut, you will be sorry you spoke up.
Yeah.
You know, and so the environmental movement, many of them, although opposed to NAFTA, opposed to GATT expansion, the environmental movement, the union movement, they had to limit what they could say. And that created an environment where, you know, they had to – so they were in a position to talk to the administration going forward. And so, you know, one of the problems that Martin O'Malley has is that, you know, speaking to more establishment Democrats than Bernie Sanders would, how can you get money from these people? Because, you know, as soon as you put money down on an anti-Clinton candidate, you're dead to them. The Clintons, that is. And, you know, you don't wound a king in politics. That's just not going to be useful. And so I think that that's a problem for Martin O'Malley. Martin O'Malley is a pretty interesting character. You know, one of the more compelling moments is his ability to really take politics with the kind of joy and fun that you sometimes used to see, but not so much in our stage managed era.
Yeah.
We had there was a big celebration for Fort McHenry, you know, in the War of 1812 recently. We had our bicentennial. And there's this wonderful picture of Martin O'Malley dressed as an early American officer on a horse, you know, as part of the ceremony. Now, not every politician in America would do that, but Maryland tends to have pretty colorful governors, and Martin O'Malley was one of them. It just, and he has some interesting ideas about, you know, in a much more working class way, by the way, than Hillary Clinton. You know, his family is struggling to pay to have a number of children in college at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, it's a much more ordinary American kind of experience. But Martin O'Malley has got two basic problems. One, he was mayor of Baltimore before he was governor, and the problems of Baltimore in recent months don't really speak well to how Maryland had been run. Second thing is, you know, there's a Republican governor of Maryland right now, and if you can't get your successor elected, your former lieutenant governor, Anthony Brown, was defeated by Governor Hogan. That also raises questions about your capacity, because Maryland is as blue a state as just about any. And if the Democrats can't keep the governor's office in Maryland, you know, how good is the O'Malley political operation? And so, as you look at the Democratic field, Hillary Clinton basically cleared the field of her most serious rivals. Biden chose not to run, apparently. Warren has said she's not going to run. And so you're left with Martin O'Malley and Bernie Sanders and Jim Webb, all of whom have their appeal, but not necessarily the ability to raise money or draw enough national attention to themselves to compete effectively.
Dr. Stephen Farnsworth here from the University of Mary Washington. He's a professor of political science and international affairs and the director of the Center for Leadership and Media Studies. More coming up on Town Talk as we continue to talk about the presidential race on News Talk 1230 WFVA. It's 8:33.
Okay, listen, we got to talk about something.
Talk done right. News Talk 1230 WFVA Fredericksburg, a Centennial Broadcasting Station. You're listening to Town Talk with Ted on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Got an opinion about today's show? Voice it now on Facebook. Search News Talk 1230 WFVA and place your comments now. Here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
University of Mary Washington political analyst Dr. Stephen Farnsworth here this morning as we talk politics. We were talking Donald Trump in the last segment. Back to him for just a second, Dr. Farnsworth. What happens if he decides to be like Ross Perot and decides to run third party? That I would think that that's a big problem for the Republicans.
Well, it's a big problem for the Republicans, to be sure. But, you know, there's no real way to stop Donald Trump. You know, the man has his own money, and even if nobody in America wants to donate to him, he can donate to himself. So there's a real possibility that the scenario for 2016 is that a more establishment Republican like Jeb Bush, who can raise a lot of money, who has the support of a lot of Republican elites, ends up being the nominee. Trump, feeling like the nomination was taken from him by these elites, envisions a third-party campaign, just like Ross Perot in 92. And that could be a real problem, because if you look at a race that has the establishment Democrat, Hillary Clinton, the establishment Republican, Jeb Bush, and Trump, you know, those are the two candidates he'd most want to run against if he had a third-party campaign. So I think that, you know, that's a real possibility, a real potential problem for the Republicans, because when the Republican Party is trying to figure out a way to broaden its support, particularly among Latinos and Asian Americans, particularly among women, it's creating a difficult environment to prevail when Donald Trump is saying the things that he's saying. You know, you don't really broaden the party's appeal by focusing all the time on immigration. It's not a useful strategy to win over swing voters. You also, you know, look at Donald Trump, and he's not necessarily the best candidate to reach those centrist voters. He offends as many people as he excites.
He's mainly been talking about immigration. That's been his issue. It will be interesting to see what happens with some other issues, because I would seem anyway that he's going to have to talk about other issues besides immigration.
Well, imagine Donald Trump trying to work out a negotiated settlement with the Iranians or the Palestinians or the Israelis. I mean, it just does not seem like something that would really play well. What would Donald Trump do in terms of dealing with the Russians and the Chinese? He doesn't talk about these things. He doesn't have experience with these things. But I cannot imagine that in the give and take that is the natural order of things of foreign policy, that Donald Trump would be all that thoughtful, deliberate, or effective.
And I guess that's what the Jeb Bushes, the Scott Walkers, the Rand Pauls are going to will try to emphasize.
Well, absolutely. My guess is that in the first debate, it will be everybody against Trump. And that may very well lead to increased approval numbers for Trump, because it's going to look like nine people are ganging up on him. But no doubt about it, there's very few Republicans who are excited at the prospect of Donald Trump being the Republican nominee. The concern that any huge field is going to bring to either party is that it's going to create a lot of enemies as they attack each other, and going to create a lot of frustration. I mean, if you look back to 2012, Mitt Romney was seriously wounded in that nomination process. If Mitt Romney, well, let's call him Mitt Romney 1.0, the moderate governor of Massachusetts, had been the Republican nominee, he would have been much more competitive in the general election than Mitt Romney 2.0, the one who had said a lot of very conservative things to beat Santorum in the primaries, and then have to do this 180-degree pivot to become the centrist candidate that he actually already was when he faced the general election, because he had to sort of unsay the things that he said. And it's pretty hard to do that with all the videotape and everything out there, and everybody with their smartphones. Every moment is recorded. And mm-hmm. So you can't say one thing in March and another thing in October and get away with it.
Chris Christie got into the race a few weeks ago, and he's an interesting. I mean, he's in some ways he's kind of like Trump, of where he can be very blunt in how he approaches things, but with a little bit more tact and politically a little bit more politically savvy.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the Christie campaign is Trump, but with experience, and maybe, you know, not quite so crazy. You know, maybe that's how Christie would argue this. I mean, Christie has actually been governor. He's in his second term.
Yeah.
He has passed budgets. He has worked with Democrats. He has worked with Republicans. There is a trajectory of things that he has done. He was a prosecutor before he was governor. He has a resume that suggests that, much more so than Trump, he's prepared to be a chief executive. And I think that you get that experience, plus the combativeness that does resonate with a lot of voters with Christie. The challenge that Christie has, though, is that he's in a channel of Republicans that is getting a little crowded. If you think about the Republican Party and the different factions of the party, you have Tea Party, you have Libertarians, you have Christian conservatives, you have centrist, more pro-business-oriented Republicans. And so in that centrist, more business-oriented Republicans, you have, I would argue, the Jeb Bush folks, you have the Christie folks. This is where Kasich would end up when he gets into the mm-hmm. race. And so you have a series of candidates who are really sort of competing for what is a slice of the Republican Party. And not a particularly large one when you compare those moderate pro-business Republicans to, say, the size of the evangelical supporters or the Tea Party Republicans. And so those groups are much larger. And so the problem that Christie has is he's kind of boxed in with other moderates. And that is a potential problem not only for Christie but for Kasich. The theory is that Bush would also be in that category and would also be taking some of those votes away. So it may be that Christie's best prospects would have been 4 years ago when he would have had that sort of more centrist Republican area mainly to himself or with Mitt Romney.
Dr. Stephen Farnsworth from the University of Mary Washington here this morning. You've kind of talked about this, but how whoever turns out to be the candidate for the Republican Party, how much do they have to make sure that they've got Tea Party involvement and enthusiasm? Because it's said that in the last cycle, the last presidential cycle, at the end, a lot didn't vote for, weren't as enthused about Mitt Romney and didn't go to the polls on Election Day.
Well, it's certainly a challenge. The thing that the Republican Party has to deal with is an America that is changing very rapidly. When you look at the election that Ronald Reagan won, you're looking at an electorate that was over 80% white. You're looking at an environment that was much more hospitable to Republicans. As you look at the Republican scenario going into 2016, you know, if the Republicans do not do better with Latino voters than Romney did, they will lose. If Republicans do not do better with women voters than they did with Romney, they will lose. If Republicans do not do better with Asian Americans, they will lose. If they do not do better than they did with under 30 voters, they will lose. And so you're looking at a very, very difficult environment because the electorate is changing. Younger people, and I'm around 20-year-olds all the time, they yeah. cannot understand many of them. Even college Republicans at Mary Washington find it incredible that the party is creating such a focus on opposition to gay marriage. It's a generational thing that you really do see that even people who would identify as Republicans would say that the Republican Party is losing a lot of young people on the question of this issue of gay marriage. And it may be that the Supreme Court, although Republicans and conservatives tend not to like what the Supreme Court did, the Supreme Court might very well have done the Republican Party a great favor because it will be less prominent in the election cycle than it would have been otherwise if this debate were still out there. So, you know, this is a challenge. You have to reach these people. And one of the things that we know from studying generational politics is that the time to reach young people is in their first or their second election cycle. It's sort of like, you know, people getting exposed to Coke or Pepsi. You know, at first they may not have any real preference, but after a bit of time spent thinking about which soda they prefer, you know, they know which one they want. Similarly with politics, you know, people can see things to like among the Democratic issues, among the Republican issues, and they're not sure where they're really going to find themselves. But after a couple of election cycles, you know, people get pretty fixed. Like people roughly my age, I'm, you know, in my 50s, you know, the first election that we voted in, it was Ronald Reagan representing Republicans and Jimmy Carter or Walter Mondale representing mm-hmm. the Democrats. And my generational cohort is much more Republican than people, say, 10 years younger than we are, who voted in their first election about a Democratic Party represented by Bill Clinton and a Republican Party represented by Bob Dole. And so the challenge that you know the Republican Party has in this election cycle is how to speak to those 20, 22, 24-year-olds. Because if they don't offer a more effective measure of speaking to their issues, they've lost them for life. And that's going to be a significant problem. This is an issue that, you know, that Donald Trump does not help the Republicans on, because not only are the young, under 30s more supportive of gay marriage, they're also more supportive of some sort of path to citizenship. And it just doesn't look right to them to see a Republican Party that is talking without, you know, without evidence, because Donald Trump is making all the headlines for the Republicans at the moment, talking about this. I mean, Jeb Bush would be a much more effective candidate in terms of path to citizenship issues, in terms of those kinds of concerns that would speak to younger voters than a guy like Donald Trump is. What Donald Trump does is he speaks to anger, but he really speaks to middle-aged anger and above. And that's not an area where the Republicans are going to have a hard time convincing people to vote for them. Their challenges are not the over 50 white people. They're going to do very well with those voters, no matter who the nominee is. The challenge is to get to 50% plus one. To get to those 270 electoral votes, they're going to have to deal with states that are more ethnically and racially diverse than they were 4 years ago. And they're going to have to deal with an electorate where a significant number of young people have their doubts about the Republican Party. And that's a challenge.
As we've talked today, one of the names that we don't talk about, and real quick on this, and we'll take a break and come back and finish talking about we'll talk about redistricting. Bob McDonnell. I thought last week when the appeals court decision came down, hadn't thought of him in a long time, and I thought there was a name that in this election cycle, in some way, a few years ago, we thought, you know, might be a name up there talked about, but he's being talked about in a very different way now.
Yes, both of them involve federal housing, but jail is not the White House.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and so I think that the story of Bob McDonnell is a tragic one. You know, you were talking about somebody, you know, who really could have been very viable as a presidential candidate.
Yeah.
Evangelical Christians liked him, but he didn't scare moderate voters. He was able to speak as a likable, genuine person to a lot of people around Virginia, and really the most successful Republican since George Allen, it seems to me. I mm-hmm. think that, you know, this was the most compelling statewide Republican candidate in a generation, and that, you know, is gone for obvious reasons. It's astonishing the poor judgment that was shown. Anybody with national political ambitions, or, you know, just simply governing in a way that would keep their political futures more viable, should have thought twice when all these things came in. I think that, you know, the jury did not spend a long time debating McDonnell's guilt. When they looked at $160,000 plus of various goodies in terms of loans and gifts and everything else, they just didn't feel right about it. And that smell test, I think, is something that most people in politics would be pretty careful about. They don't want to look like they're being bought. Now, we could argue about the verdict, of course, you know, how much quo was there for all that quid. But the truth is, the jury looked at this, and the jury did not spend a lot of time, was not really divided about this. Very quickly, they came back with a conviction on almost every count for the governor. And the appeals court, in a pretty extensive conversation and an 89-page opinion, yep, basically rejected all of the appeals arguments for McDonnell. Now, there's still, of course, a couple of more legal steps that McDonnell could use. This was a panel of the appeals court. A full appeals court hearing is a possibility, and of course, there's the Supreme Court after that. So there are two sort of legal issues to go through, but it may very well be the key issue. In terms of whether or not McDonald's going to jail, was this appeals decision that was reached last week.
Dr. Stephen Farnsworth here. More in Town Talk and News Talk 1230 WFVA.
Welcome back to Town Talk with Ted on News Talk 1230 WFBA. You can weigh in on today's Town Talk topic on Facebook. Just search News Talk 1230 WFBA. Now, your host, Ted Schubel.
Dr. Stephen Farnsworth, the professor of political science and international affairs and the director of the Center for Leadership and Media Studies at the University of Mary Washington here. You getting ready? I guess, is it in the fall that you do your – you'll do a poll, a statewide poll?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll do a fall poll probably.
So when we get near that, we'll have you back and talk about that. I got a question for you from Facebook this morning. A listener asks, do you see any pathway to Medicaid expansion, and will the governor be able to enact fair redistricting reform?
Well, the simple answer, I know we don't have a lot of time, no and no. With respect to Medicaid expansion, the Republicans in gerrymandered districts, most of them, are only having to worry about their primary opponents, not the general election opponents, because of the way the lines are drawn. And so any Republican who tries to cooperate with a Democratic governor on Medicaid expansion would be defeated in a primary by a Tea Party opponent. So that's not going to happen. The governor can't do it unilaterally. We know that now. So Medicaid expansion is off the table for the foreseeable future in Virginia. With respect to redistricting reform, the Constitution gives the House of Delegates the opportunity and the authority to set these district lines. And if you give, you know, like giving your students the opportunity to grade their own exams, if you give people the opportunity to look out for themselves, they will do just that. And so you have a situation where there's not much opportunity for redistricting reform. There is some issues with the courts. The courts may say that this was too gerrymandered here in Virginia. That's what they've said with respect to the congressional districts. Yeah. There's another case pending with respect to the House of Delegate districts. But neither one of those legal appeals are fully resolved. So we may still see more litigation before we see any lines. But even if the lines are redrawn, they're still being redrawn by a Republican legislature that presumably will look out for Republicans in the way that Democrats, when they were in the majority, looked out for Democrats.
It's always an interesting, because I know when you and I do debates, every debate we do, you ask General Assembly candidates about redistricting, just to get their views on it. Mm-hmm. And I know that's been an issue that you have followed closely. March 1st is a Super Tuesday for the presidential candidates. I guess we'll start seeing them middle of February.
Right. Virginia is going to have a primary for both parties on March 1st. And one of the key issues is who's left standing and also who qualifies for the ballot. We don't have the easiest ballot system here in Virginia. You have to collect signatures across the state in the different congressional districts. But the truth is that if you think you're capable of dealing with the Chinese, then you should be able to deal with the Virginia ballot access laws.
Dr. Stephen Farnsworth with the University of Mary Washington, thank you for coming in. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks.
Thank you. Have a great day.
That is it for Town Talk. Thank you for listening. Have a great weekend. And thank you from News Talk 1230 WFVA.
Thanks for listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. The views expressed by the host and guests on this program are their own and not necessarily those of this station, its management, or Centennial Broadcasting. The Glenn Beck program is next on News Talk 1230 WFVA.